beer in hand and say, "Nope, my job here is to enhance the conversation." And enhance it he did, with jokes and complete recitals of Rudyard Kipling and other military poems. When he wasn't playing Gentleman John, though, Johnny was a tiger. The main reason he was up at battalion was that I'd pulled him out of his platoon in Abu Company when he started doing Harry the Horse-like stunts. I knew in my gut if I didn't, he'd get wasted. Also at the poker table in Fan Rang, though I hated to admit it, I finally met my match. Captain Benjamin L. Willis, a volunteer replacement from MACV, was the best poker player I'd met since Dell Evans in Korea. My longtime belief that great warriors were or should be great poker players was certainly borne out by Ben. His incredible common sense and Street Fighter's cunning belied his West Point education. Even he said most academy graduates were too smart to be infantrymen, and he freely admitted he'd graduated at the bottom of his class. I had enormous respect for Willis's judgment and ability. In my view, he was probably one of the best American guerrilla fighters in the Republic of Vietnam. And if I personally taught him anything in the three tours we would ultimately serve together, in the early days of our friendship, he taught me even more. From time to time, on nights when poker got old and or a fair amount of boozing had gone down, we'd conduct a raid on downtown Phan Rang, specifically on Madam New's House of Pleasure. It hadn't taken long to find out who shared my view of combat soldiers and sex, those of rampant libido, as Johnny Howard so succinctly would observe. On the nights themselves, I'd send word down to the company CPs that Major Hackworth requests your presence at Madam News, and when all interested officers were assembled, normally a wild, drunken mob, we'd pile into jeeps and head into town. Usually, the subsequent events were pretty straightforward, although one notable exception was the night everyone wanted a second round, and no one had enough money to pay for it. The Vietnamese madam happily accepted a transistor radio as compensation for her girl's double rations rendered. The radio belonged to one of the lieutenants, though God only knew why he'd brought it along. From that point, we had it made in the shade until the MP started banging on the whorehouse door, presumably because of all the airborne jeeps outside. My guys were all on the second floor. As the situation hotted up, we scrambled to make our getaway, and I found myself scaling down the side of the building with another battalion officer, employing tactics neither of us had used since our rappelling training days back at Fort Campbell. Fortunately, the whole group got out intact, and we soon roared off into the night, beyond the clutches of the law. We were like a college varsity football team, and I was the coach and captain. I didn't think twice about drinking and gambling and letting off steam with the men off hours. I always thought the Army's rule against fraternizing with subordinates was wrong anyway. If you can tell them to die, you should be able to get blasted with them, as long as they knew that come the morning it was all duty, and they got no break from partying with the boss. Of course, they got no break from not partying with the boss either. When a contingent of the young officers went to the opening of the base camp's brigade officers club, didn't invite me along, and got themselves into a huge drunken fight, I was the one who got my ass chewed by Colonel Rogers, who correctly believed I was responsible for infusing the fighters with such wild spirit. I wouldn't have minded this if I'd been invited, but as it was, the following morning I assembled all the transgressors. "You're a bunch of bums," I said. "That was a brand new club you destroyed. Are you crazy? I'm telling you now, and I'm only going to say it once. This drinking to excess has got to stop. Do you understand?" Judging from their collective hungover moans as they shuffled slowly out of the room, my young friends got the message. That evening I paid my own visit to the brigade officers' club. Hancock came with me, and we seriously tied one on. When we came staggering home, we decided we ought to drop by the battalion's talk and give the duty officer, who that night happened to be Gentleman John Howard, a hard time. As luck would have it, all was quiet, and Johnny was asleep when we arrived. We woke him up by grabbing his hands and feet, and before he could even protest, we carried him out of the talk, tied him to the hood of my jeep, and proceeded to drive him all around the base camp. Johnny had been one of the guys who'd withstood my morning tirade on the abuse of alcohol. When we finally untied him from the jeep, he just looked at me, deadpan, and said, "So much for a new perspective on moderation, sir." To be able to successfully slip between the roles of buddy and boss was a skill I'd learned from Steve Prezenka and the other trust NCOs. The 1-3-2-7 officers accepted the ground rules. As Tiger Lieutenant Dennis Foley later explained it, I had an ability to violate one rule of leadership, and that was overfamiliarity breeds contempt. You could be overly familiar with Hack, he said, but it was always on his terms, because when he pulled the reins back, it was as if you never even knew he had a first name. We could go out with him and raise all kinds of hell till dawn, but the next day, God forbid we mentioned that we went or failed to perform adequately or looked as if we were hungover or needed some sleep, we soldiered, and it was not discussed. And it was with this understanding that a foundation of love and respect was established all around, which would add mightily to the battalion's strength not long down the track. I'd liked Dennis Foley from the minute I met him. He was a tall, skinny, bespectacled kid, an army brat who'd gone to OCS after a couple of years enlisted service. When I gave him command of one of the Tiger platoons, I'd also given him my Sergeant Sweeney talk. Foley was as ashen-faced as most lieutenants were when confronted with the fact that they didn't know shit about leading troops, but according to Phil Belden, the old pro NCO who actually ran the unit while Foley learned, the new lieutenant was shaping up fine. One thing Foley was a bit slower off the mark with, though, was the art of scrounging, a fact that became painfully clear to me the day I received the humiliating news that he and his boss, Tiger CO Jim Gardner, had been caught in the act. Apparently, the two had decided they were going to scrounge a refrigerator for the HQ company mess, a fine and generous idea, from the USAF base just down the road at Phan Rang. Their fatal error had been to trust the Air Force lieutenant they met at the USAF Officers Club, who, in a moment of drunken camaraderie, told them the easiest way to get a refrigerator was to use his name at the base's supply dump. The flyboy was correct. But just as Gardner and Foley finished loading up the refrigerator, no questions asked, and started driving away, back at the bar, the supply lieutenant got scared and reported everything to the air police. Within minutes, my Tigers, who were probably drunker than the Air Force lieutenant, were ambushed by the base security guards. And when confronted with the fact that they had a stolen refrigerator in the back of their truck, they confidently maintained that it must have fallen in. The first I heard of the matter was the late-night call I got from an irate USAF colonel. When he finished chewing my ass, which took a fair while, I told him I'd take care of it. And two very drunk Tiger lieutenants sobered up quickly when told by the colonel to report to me ASAP. "Can't we just go to Leavenworth?" young Foley reportedly asked. I was mad as hell, but the two lieutenants needn't have worried. I didn't want a pound of flesh. I just couldn't believe that these two guys, these two Tigers, had screwed up so badly. It wouldn't have happened in the Raiders. "Just don't let it happen again," I roared as the two men stood miserably at attention before me. "If you can't do it without getting caught, then don't do it at all." General Westmoreland visited the brigade at Thanksgiving. Hands on hips, his square jaw jutting out, he stood on a box and inspired the troops with cheers that we were beating the VC into near submission. Before he left, the brigade was issued per man two little cards to carry around in the jungle and study like the Bible. One was MACV's 9-rule card, which spelled out MACV policy for winning the hearts and minds of the people, and the other, the Standing Orders Rogers Rangers, written in 1759. Listen in the appendix. The latter item was a decided plus. Even Maxwell D. Taylor had said the VC was an enemy as shrewd, well-trained, and with the guile of the American Indian during his best days. And Major Robert Rogers' 200-year-old guidelines were as applicable in Vietnam as they'd been in the American colonies during the French Indian and Revolutionary Wars. Unfortunately, the card creators at MACV HQ in Saigon soon went into the same overdrive as the research and development people in Washington. Before the Vietnam War was over, American combat soldiers would virtually need a truck to carry all their prompt cards, a troop leading card, a code of conduct card, a patrol leader's card, a mines and booby trap card, a 5-paragraph field order card, a card for every occasion card. You name it, the troops had it. The holiday was rounded out with the traditional Thanksgiving feast, complete with all the trimmings. It tasted great, despite what old paratrooper First Sergeant Leo B. Smith told me, that at least one of the turkeys was 25 years old, a surplus bird frozen since the Second World War. Still, I couldn't help but marvel at how screwed up MacV's priorities continued to be. After 4 months in Vietnam and a home-style nothing-is-too-good-for-the-troops Thanksgiving dinner, we were still short on essentials. Jungle boots, jungle fatigues, gun patches, oil, and cleaning rods. After 4 months in Vietnam, no one had recognized that the 1-101 was not being used in a normal airborne role, and we were still ridiculously ill-equipped in terms of vehicles, weapons, and equipment to function as the regular infantry unit we'd become. Traditionally, paratroopers were lightly equipped, in-and-out troops who, after an operation, immediately went back to Army Reserve to train, refit, and await another jump mission. As such, traditionally, the airborne didn't need a lot of vehicles or a long logistic trail. So as delicious as that turkey dinner was, there was no question that the troopers would have been a lot more thankful on Thanksgiving 1965 if MacV had given us chicken sandwiches instead and spent their time, energy, and money addressing our critical operational shortages. Thanksgiving had barely passed when the 7th Arvin Regiment was decimated in a battle with Main Force VC units at the Michelin Rubber Plantation near Ben Cot, just 45 kilometers northwest of Saigon. The VC had had the run of the rich rubber country around Ben Cot and nearby Lai K for 20 years. The area had been the birthplace of the Viet Minh's insurgent effort against the French, and though our predecessors had fought many a bloody battle there, in the end, it was always the guerrillas who prevailed. Curiously, the French-owned Michelin plant had operated continuously in this VC stronghold since the fall of Dien Bien Phu, its only acknowledgement of the ongoing war being signs all over the place demanding that combatants not damage the trees. October 1965 put an end to the operations, however, and to this typical French complacency when the VC infiltrated the plantation, demanded taxes from the owners, and made a lasting impression on all the workers by executing their South Vietnamese foreman right in front of them. Michelin closed down, and the 7th Arvin was sent in to guard the real estate. Upon their routing, a disaster only compounded when American aircraft dropped HE bombs right in the middle of a 350-man relief unit of Arvin Rangers, General Westmoreland ordered a massive retaliatory operation to secure the plantation and get the VC. His choice of Allied units for the job, elements of the U.S. 1st Division, the 173rd, the 1st Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, 1 RAR, and a 2-battalion task force from the 101st, was, to me, unstated testimony that he and Dupuy had concluded the Arvin didn't have a hope in hell of winning this war, and it would soon become, if it was not basically already, an all-American show. The initial role of Tim's traveling trouble in this operation was to take over the defense of Bien Hoa Airfield from the 173rd and 1 RAR. The Aussies were under the operational control, OpCon, of the 173rd as its third maneuver element, while those two units conducted operations. It wasn't bad duty, though the troopers were restless and aching for a fight. With the exception of Saigon, Bien Hoa, halfway between Saigon and Lai K Ben Cot, was as close to the land of the Big PX as one could probably get in South Vietnam in 1965. Lavish air-conditioned clubs with floor shows, open-air barbecues, slot machines, long, slick bars with drinks no more than 2 bits a shot, top-quality food, and even Broadway entertainment, most recently Hello Dolly starring Mary Martin. Pinch me, I thought when we first arrived. For a minute there I thought I was supposed to be in a war zone. The last time I'd been to Bien Hoa was in June during the advance party days. While the other members of our party were farmed out to the individual units already deployed to observe, learn, and be prepared to pass this knowledge on to their own units when they arrived, I'd taken the opportunity to visit almost all the U.S. outfits in the field to get an overall view of what was happening. The walkabout had proved invaluable, if only to find there was little point in placing any of our party with the U.S. Marines, who were operating in the north up in I Corps, or with the 173rd at Bianhua because they would only learn bad habits. It was not that the Marines or the 173rd were short on good soldiers or strong leaders, but they were sloppy on the basics of staying alive in an armed environment, and their gung-ho assault-em-on-the-beachhead or drop-zone tactics could not have been more wrong for a guerrilla war. I'd quickly discovered that besides the U.S. Special Forces A-teams, who ran and manned along with the Montagnards soldiers they'd trained, the Civilian Irregular Defense Group, CIDG, Frontier Border Camps, it was the Australians, under the command of one Lieutenant Colonel Brumfield, who seemed to be the most knowledgeable in terms of how to fight a guerrilla in the jungle environment. So I'd begun encouraging the infantry members of the advance party to mosey on over to one RAR to have a look. The Australians' expertise was not exactly surprising. It was based on experience gained not just in their Australia-based training program, which concentrated solely on jungle warfare at a 10,000-acre tropical rainforest training ground, but also on the jungle battlegrounds of New Guinea and Borneo during World War II, as well as during the post-war Malayan conflict, a war of insurgency the Aussies shared with the Brits for a dozen years. Historically, the Australians were a well-respected foe, a fact expressed by Field Marshal Erwin Rommel a quarter of a century before, when he said during the fighting in Africa, "Those damn Australians." A single admonition found in a captured VC diary proved the Aussies had already made a similar impression in the present conflict. "When you're engaging the Australians," it warned, "watch your flanks with special care." Major John Essex Clark was the 1RAR's S3. He was a giant of a man and a stud of a soldier. One of the last battlefield commissions in the British Army, he'd spent 13 years fighting guerrillas in Rhodesia and the Belgian Congo, and 2 years on long patrols on special operations in Malaya. We'd met during the advance party days, and even in that short time he'd taught me plenty about guerrilla fighting. Now that the 1st Brigade was at Bianhua, we had a chance to become reacquainted, and not a few beers were sloshed down at the Bianhua USAF Officers Club as we picked up where we'd left off. Essex Clark was no more impressed these days than he'd been when we first met by the large unit, company, and battalion-sized tactics of his gung-ho American counterparts in the 173rd. The Aussies used squads to make a contact and brought in reinforcing elements to do the killing. They planned in the belief that a platoon on the battlefield could do anything, including get out. While the 1-101 was starting to develop small unit tactics with the Tigers and Hank Emerson's Recondos, what would prove to be the biggest stumbling block to the widespread adoption of such tactics among the Americans was senior commanders' unwillingness to break down their organizations into such seemingly devourable chunks. And this was despite the not uncommon attitude expressed to John Essex Clark by one American brigadier general in the early days of the war, to wit, "We've got to take casualties. If we don't, the Vietnamese won't believe we're serious about this." In any event, I still maintained that the Australians understood the war better than our guys ever would. So at Bianhua, I pitched Essex Clark a cross-training proposal I'd been thinking about since we first met. That of sending above the rest platoon leaders over to the pros at 1RAR to gain jungle fighting knowledge that they could bring back and infuse throughout their units. Essex Clark agreed to the idea, and we decided on a post-Christmas start for the program to give me time to clear it with Colonel Timothy. When the brigade was relieved of its airfield security mission, we moved overland along Route 13 to Lai K and the Michelin Plantation. It was an expensive journey. Before our first day out, the 1327 had taken 3 KIA and 10 WIA when VC Command detonated mines, destroyed two of our jeeps, and a troop-carrying 2.5-ton truck. The 1st Brigade's Operation Checkerboard commenced on 12 December with a massive air mobile assault. After all the months of scratching around for whatever lift we could get, we in the 1-101st could not believe the number of helicopter assets assembled for the task. The 1st lift alone was composed of 40 UH-1D troop-carrying choppers, also known as Hueys or Slicks, able to carry 2 complete rifle companies into the battle area simultaneously. Air mobile assaults were both exciting and frightening. Each one was a gut-churning event not dissimilar to the moment before you unassed an airplane with the parachute on your back. The chill down your spine and the tightening in your stomach started the moment you loaded into the chopper. You sat down on your steel pot. Few trusted the Huey's thin underbelly to keep them in full possession of their most vital organs, and soon you were bolting skyward, as if ascending in a high-speed elevator. The slicks moved in a line, like giant locusts approaching the LZ. They swung into a big orbit, staying out of the way of the TAC air preparing the ground below. You could see the napalm and cluster bomblets crunching down and the big geysers created by heavier bombs. Then the TAC air aircraft pulled away with a flourish, and artillery rained down as the slicks were joined mid-air by gunships, which would, when the artillery was lifted, hose down the tree lines with machine guns, rockets, and fast-firing M79 guns, while the slicks sat down and discharged their troops. Only when they'd landed did the slicks' door gunners open up, while troopers, 8 per bird, 4 per door, hit the ground running with hearts in mouths, bent double to avoid the whirling thump-thump-thump of the chopper blades, through the noise and confusion to secure the tree line for subsequent lifts to go in without covering fire. It was a concerto of awesome firepower coordinated with split-second timing, an intricate ballet of man and machine. Everybody had to have his act together, troopers, crews, artillery, and Air Force supporters, because on top of everything else, it all happened at more than 100 miles an hour. I was on the ground with the troops during checkerboard, sent, with no need for a second invitation, by Colonel Rogers to see how the companies were doing since the fan rang game of company command musical chairs. No major contacts with the VC occurred during the operation. While the Lai K Ben Khot area proved to be a major logistic base for the Viet Cong, complete with a hospital complex, training facilities, and large unit base camps and mess halls, judging from the lack of booby traps among these installations and the freshly prepared, still warm food we found in cooking pots, the VC units who lived there had decided to run away rather than take us on. Still, they left calling cards throughout the rubber plantation and double canopy jungle, making the battlefield particularly grim. Like Quy Nhon, wherever a trooper walked, there seemed to be a mine or an explosive booby trap. We had a number of casualties and countless near misses. Other primitive but highly effective devices we encountered included tiger traps with their razor-sharp bamboo spears at the bottom, but much worse were the huge logs the enemy had rigged up and hidden in the trees. The unlucky infantryman who sprang the concealed tripwire of one of these would find 200 pounds of teak, usually studded with spikes, catapulting down on him at 50 miles per hour. The jungle held the routine unpleasantries of red ants and leeches as well, but more dangerous to the soldiers was their own behavior within the bush. Just one example was the several friendly casualties that occurred when a grenade was tossed, hit the trees, and bounced back on the troops. It was a common accident. The men still had not come to terms with jungle fighting. The Screaming Eagle's long orientation for desert warfare was one of our worst enemies. The overall lack of training for this terrain had troopers sounding and acting like a herd of elephants crashing through the forest. Nowhere was this more clear to me than when Operation Checkerboard drew to a close and I accompanied Lieutenant Pat Graves' B Company platoon on the way out of the jungle. It was an experience that made me well respect the enormous difficulties the ground pounder in Vietnam faced. Machetes wielded against the dense, uncompromising bush that rose into double and triple canopy, making the day like night. Point men changed again and again as the exhausting job of hacking through it overtook them. Then suddenly, the dark, dank, impenetrable jungle opened up. But it did not reveal daylight. Instead, the presence, 5 feet in front of us, of another unit. Fortunately, they were second of the 502nd guys doing the exact same thing we were. Due to Graves's unerring navigation, we'd hacked our way right into our link-up point with the O2. But what was most amazing was that neither group had heard or seen the other until that very moment, both so busily and loudly hacking away. It was just good luck all around that neither was VC. But where were the VC? While Checkerboard proved successful in terms of disrupting the enemy's logistic system, VC tunnels were blown up, Half-built VC villages were burned down, enormous quantities of rice, ammunition, and items such as VC black pajamas were uncovered and destroyed. The major purpose of the five-day mission, to find and destroy the VC unit that had mauled the 7th Arvin Regiment, was not met. In the biggest U.S. operation to date, with probably 15,000 troops beating the bushes, we failed to even find the enemy, that is, in large formations or numbers, much less destroy him. But where had he gone? He had to go somewhere. No doubt to his sanctuaries in Cambodia, or somewhere within the densely forested War Zone D, adjacent to the Cambodian border, or War Zone C, which led virtually to the gates of Saigon, or perhaps even under our very feet in his vast tunnel complexes. So early in the war, the failure of Operation Checkboard to find the enemy was ample illustration of the limitation of the Americans' large-scale, incredibly expensive multi-battalion operations. They were simply no match for a cunning foe who lived by Mao's conviction, "Give me a path wide enough to move a mule, and I will move an army." Christmas came and went. And on 27 December, Lieutenants Harry the Horse Godwin, Pat Graves, and John Dorland, another fine West Point stud, went over to 1RAR in Bien Hoa, as John Essex Clark and I had agreed. The three lieutenants commanded platoons in each of the first of the 327th's rifle companies. The plan was that they'd stay with the Aussies for a month, bring back to their companies their lessons learned, and if the program proved worthwhile, they would be followed by three more of our lieutenants. I hadn't exactly cleared this cross-training idea with Colonel Timothy. When I'd brought the subject up, he'd said he'd have to check with the people in Saigon, and within days, word had come back that the concept was a no-go, the reason given that sending American troops, particularly troops from the 101st, America's finest, to the Aussies, would be like admitting we didn't know what the hell we were doing. Since I thought the issue was a little more critical than MacV's potentially bruised pride, I then assessed the likelihood of being found out if I ignored the guidance and sent the lieutenants anyway. When I concluded the odds weighed heavily in my favor, I'd gone ahead. It was selective insubordination that I truly believed would benefit the whole battalion. Although the 1st Brigade, 101st Airborne Division, would continue to play fire brigade the rest of its first year in Vietnam, the days of Tim's traveling trouble were coming to an end. In early January, Colonel Timothy led the 2nd of the 327th and the 2nd of the 502nd on his last operation with the brigade before moving on to play coup to become the 2-Corps senior advisor. The operation took the two battalions to the city of Tuy Hoa, 100 miles to the north, and its rice paddies by the sea. In years past, 80% of the rice harvest there had been gobbled up by the Viet Cong. The mission of the brigade was, as it had been at Quy Nhon, to protect the farmers and their crop, even as they found Charlie and kicked his ass. The 1st of the 327th was left behind to secure the brigade's base camp, and to conduct operations in VC-controlled villages southwest of Phan Rang. For us at Phan Rang, the month of January was pretty uneventful. The high point of all was when a Tiger Force medic, who also happened to be an American Indian, somehow missed an air mobile assault and, in the fine tradition of his forefathers, traveled overland alone through VC territory until he tracked down his unit in the middle of the jungle. Though the supply situation was improving all the time, by Christmas we'd been set up with most essentials through regular supply channels, the above the rest had well augmented its share through its enthusiastic scrounging effort, which was ongoing in the first month of 1966. But how far Hancock and friends had gone to upgrade our standard of living, I don't think even I comprehended until Colonel Timothy's successor, Brigadier General Willard Pearson, whom few of us knew anything about except that he'd most recently been an assistant division commander in the 101st at Campbell, joined me in a chopper to have an orientation look at the base camp from the air a week or so before he took over the brigade. We flew over the 2nd of the 327th's area, and below us we saw a few dozen tents. Then we flew over the O2 strike force, which also had a few dozen tents. When we got over my battalion, which, thanks to Hancock and his merry men, had a GP tent for virtually every 11-man squad, from the air it looked as if we had a million tents. "Where'd you get all those tents?" General Pearson asked. It was a logical question. "We scrounged them, sir," I replied, praying that this unknown quantity of a commander-to-be was not going to be a strict bookman, and General Pearson didn't say another word. My guess, as I looked down at my unit area with a mixture of heartfelt pride and great relief, was that the new commander didn't want to know. And it was true, he didn't. Pearson had no time for the small stuff. He had already moved on, pondering how his new command might get the VC even better. 15. The Year of the Horse. If you were encountering problems that he didn't think were problems, he'd call you on the radio and really chew your ass. He called me one afternoon and he wanted something done, and I said, "Hey, we've already been at this for a couple of days and we're falling on our ass. We're tired." He said, "I don't give a damn what your problems are. You guys get moving." So I grumbled a bit and he said, "Look, if you don't think you can do it, put your second in command in charge." Well, we went ahead and did it. As it turned out, we were able to do just what he wanted us to do. He was the kind of guy who understood the necessity to drive people beyond what their normal capability might be. He made us all understand that combat is a battle of wills as much as it is a battle of physically doing in the enemy, and you've really got to be a stronger-willed fighter than he is if you eventually want to beat him. And he was able to impart that to his commanders very well, but sometimes he could be damn ruthless about doing it. Brigadier General John C. Herling, B Company Commander, 1st of the 327th Battalion, 101st Airborne Infantry, Republic of Vietnam, 1966. On the 21st of January, the Vietnamese New Year, Tet, ushered in the Year of the Horse. Knowing nothing about the Chinese zodiac, I didn't know at the time that I'd actually been born under the sign of the horse 35 years before. I didn't know either that the Year of the Horse, 1966, was going to be my year, the year I established myself once and for all in the big leagues. It happened just as I would have wanted it to, on the ground, in battle, with damn good troops, and by sheer coincidence, it all began on 7 February, 15 years and one day after Sergeant Combat made his name on a frigid morning in Korea. The 2nd of the 502nd and the 2nd of the 327th were heavily committed up at Thuy Hoa. Hank Emerson's O2 was operating in a brigade-sized AO. The gunfighter, as the strike force commander had been dubbed, had fights going on all over the battlefield. He'd already committed his reserve when the morning of 7 February brought that one fight too many. Elements of Emerson's C Company, commanded by Captain Robert Murphy, were pinned down and in danger of being flanked and destroyed by an NVA force of unknown size. The 1st of the 327th had been called up from Phan Rang a couple of days before for just such a contingency. Now, new brigade commander Pearson said he wanted me to take a task force to relieve and reinforce Murphy. "You have the Tigers and Bravo Company," he said. "Now go get 'em." I assembled a light CP group, which included the Assistant Battalion S3, Don Chapman, our 2nd of the 320th Artillery LNO, Don Corman, myself, and all relevant RTOs, and hopped into a waiting chopper. We made contact with Murphy, who was mighty cheerful for a guy whose company was up against a force with what he estimated were at least a dozen machine guns, and after having a good look at the battle area, we selected LZs, coordinated fire support, and returned to Thuy Hoa, where I briefed Bravo's CO Al Heiser and Tiger Commander Jim Gardner on the plan. Murphy's company was stuck in the northwest corner of the bombed-out ruins of a village called Mi Con 2. My idea was to have the Tigers come up on the surrounded unit's flank, while B Company swung around to the south and set up a blocking position deep behind the enemy. After TAC air and artillery preparation, the Tigers would hit the enemy and roll up their flank. I figured at that point the enemy would break contact and run, only to get caught in the trap I'd set behind them with Bravo Company. The Tigers led the way out, and I went with them. We landed at an LZ quite close to the battle area. The men spread out and moved like old pros through waist-high grass. I, on the other hand, was walking on air. I felt like a bit player at MGM might feel after years and years and years of hard work, seeing his name above the title of the movie or in lights on a theater marquee. Ever since I'd arrived in Vietnam, now some 8 months ago, I'd lived for the prospect of another combat command. Hell, I'd been dreaming of another combat command since 1953, and then to get one as a major and with the Tigers, whom I'd secretly considered my boys since the creation of the elite force, was the greatest break I could have asked for. We guided on the sound of Murphy's firefight. C Company's commander was also putting max tac air and artillery on the enemy surrounding him, but it wasn't doing much good. The enemy soldiers were belly to belly with Murphy's team, and to close them down effectively would have resulted in a hell of a lot of friendly casualties as well. We moved forward continuously, killing as we went about 10 enemy stragglers who'd been dumb enough to take pot shots at the Tigers. These men were dyed-in-the-wool NVA troops, complete with khaki uniforms and armed with AK-47s. Upon examination, members of the elite 95th NVA Regiment, the unit known to be operating in this area, whose activities during the Indochina War had given the Bloody Street Without Joy its name. They were probably the most formidable enemy fighters in South Vietnam. "Do I get the CIB now?" Don Chapman, who was hiking along behind me, asked only half-jokingly each time an enemy shot rang out. "No, Chapman, not yet," I'd reply, having a quiet chuckle, remembering what that blue badge meant to me when I went through my much-longed-for baptism of fire. We reached a small knob by a river, across which we could see Murphy's people lying on the ground around the foundations of blown-away houses. I wasn't satisfied with the update Murphy now gave me by radio, so I took advantage of a bamboo bridge that crossed the river very close to our little knob and went over to the village to see what was happening myself. Unfortunately, a wide-open field about 50 meters long lay between the far side of the bridge and Murphy's position, so when Daryl Nunley, my longtime RTO, who had to accompany me lugging his bulky PRC-25 radio, and I dashed across the bridge, we became shooting gallery ducks for some very professional marksmen armed with automatic weapons. After crawling around the battle area a little bit, talking to Murphy and eyeballing the situation as he saw it on his side of the river, Daryl and I ran back across the field and the bridge, unscathed, despite the enemy machine guns, which fired as enthusiastically at our backs as they had at our chests, arms, legs, and heads on the way over. My original plan still held. After telling Gardner that I knew about the location of enemy positions in a hedgerow to our front, I ordered the Tigers to strike the enemy's flank and roll it up, in order to unpin Murphy and send the NVA scurrying into Bravo's waiting ambush. It was a neat, clean hammer and anvil right out of Fort Benning. With that, I gathered Corman, Chapman, Nunley, and the rest of the CP group, and with the Tigers behind us providing effective covering fire, we hightailed it across the bridge. Corman, who was the best artilleryman I'd seen since Alan Bell in Korea, neutralized the fire-swept open field on the far side with smoke and HE arty shot, and though the run was a little hairy, the shortcut saved us valuable time. "Do I get my CIB now?" Chapman panted when the CP group arrived intact at Murphy's position. "No, Chapman, not yet," I said, and directed my guys to dig in fast and deep. Automatic weapons were stitching all over the area. We set up in the rubble of a bombed-out building, and while Corman put together his artillery fire plan and Daryl and the other RTOs started digging a foxhole large enough to hold the entire CP, a trick I'd learned from Colonel John Clay's Pigeons of San Lo, I took Chapman with me on a little mosey around the battle area. We crawled through the rubble of a couple of buildings, then crawled on through a ditch along a paddy dike. Suddenly, an NVA soldier popped up in front of us out of a hole he'd burrowed into the side of the dike. He was a little above us as the three of us started shooting, but we hit him first, and all his slugs went high, right over our heads. "Do I get the CIB now?" Chapman asked dryly. "You got it, man," I laughed. The first thing I saw when we got back to our command post was Daryl setting up his 2-9-2 antenna, a heavy, unwieldy son of a bitch to carry around, but worth every pound and more in terms of the best possible commo. Then I saw Corman talking on the radio. Then I saw the tigers on the attack, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Gardner and his people were walking across the open field between the bridge and Murphy's position. They'd forded the river, many of them were soaked to the neck, and now they were marching straight across that field in a perfect skirmish line like Pickett's division at Gettysburg. I was stunned. I'd given Gardner a mission-type order. I didn't tell him how to do it. He was one of the best and most experienced lieutenants in the battalion, so I just assumed he would take the well-concealed approach to Mi Khan, quite obvious from the knob where he'd begun, along a dry stream bed on his flank. Now it was too late for him to turn around, and there was no way to stop him. All the O2 guys in the village could do was start putting as much suppressive fire as they could on the face of the hedgerow to Gardner's front to keep the enemy down. Incredibly, the Tigers were taking no casualties as they advanced toward Mi Khan. In fact, it seemed as though they weren't even being fired on. But then, about 20 meters from our position, with one step, they walked into a wall of lead. Our opponent was indeed a force to be reckoned with. The discipline of this element of the 95th NVA, so skillfully dug in and camouflaged along their hedgerow wall, was iron tight. Not one shot had been fired prematurely, and when they did open up, they mowed my Tigers down from end to end across that open field. Those who survived immediately charged the tree line through the fire, an act that took courage beyond words, and from that moment on, for both Tigers and members of C-2502, it was bloody hand-to-hand with the enemy all the way. I watched from my TAC CP 40 yards away. It was like a 3D movie, a collage of khaki, green, and scarlet red, and wholly outside my experience. This wasn't guerrilla warfare as I had studied it. Not even the French had encountered this enemy tactic of hugging the belt, as it would become known, rendering any U.S. air or arty support useless. I'd read Hal Moore's Yadrang after-action report, but I'd never seen with my eyes our Viet enemy voluntarily intermingle with American troops. I'd never seen him stand and fight. It quickly became clear that he wasn't going to fall into the trap I'd set for him with Bravo, so I called Heiser and told him to punch through the enemy's rear. The dug-in NVA had numerous heavily reinforced machine gun positions at Mi Khan, but one in particular, about 100 meters from our CP, was causing problems. That machine gun had one of my elements stopped. As I talked to the TAC Air Forward air controller about closing it down, an Australian voice came through the radio. "I've got a Canberra light bomber here with 250-pound delays on board. Can you use them?" "Are you real accurate?" I asked. "I reckon," the Aussie pilot said. I told him the situation and where the bunker was, popping a smoke for reference. When he did a dry run to have a look at the bunker himself, his twin-engine bomber flew in so low I almost could have reached up from my hole and touched it. "I see it," the pilot's voice came through the radio as he pulled his plane up. "This'll be a live run, so tell your chaps to get the heads down." I watched the first bomb being released. It came in on an angle, and as it zoomed over our hole, it looked as if it was no more than a few feet away. On delay, it sank into the ground not far from the targeted bunker and exploded with an earth-shanking boom. After examining the damage, I asked the pilot if he could shift the next run 3 meters to the right. One by one, all the Canberra's bombs were dropped onto this single target. The pilot's accuracy was incredible. He was able to carry out every adjustment I made precisely, no matter how small. We never did get a direct hit on the bunker, but close enough that even the most hardcore NVA inside would have been battle-rattled into submission, if not unconsciousness. "How was that, mate?" the pilot asked when the last of his ordnance was expended. "Great, man. You saved our ass. Thanks a lot. Good hunting and good luck," he said, and flew away. "Okay, let's see if we can clean up that position now," I said to my held-up element. The men started toward the position, but rat-a-tat-tat, the minute they stuck their heads up, they felt the fury of the exact same machine gun from the exact same bunker. It was a bolt from the sky. We were all being told, even the president was being told, that our combat power, unleashed on the enemy, would either blast him back to the Stone Age or make him give up. We were being told that our air power would ultimately be the magic panacea to cure Vietnam of all its communist ills. But if we on the ground were using it as precisely and as excessively, some might say, as I'd just done on one tiny position, and it wasn't doing the job, then what the hell good was all the saturation bombing in North Vietnam? Air power was great if you caught the enemy out in the open. But if he was fighting from well-dug-in positions, as these cats were at My Con, and if the fortified positions were manned by hardcore mothers who didn't give up even after their eardrums had burst from the concussion of our bombs and blood was pouring out of their noses and their ears, then the exercise was almost counterproductive. All it did was make the enemy hate us even more and become that much more determined. So it was a mighty lesson learned in that split-second machine gun burst from a primitive mud and log and well-shook-up bunker at My Con. Whatever the answer to this war was, I certainly didn't know. But one thing I could confidently say was that bombing alone would never be it. By now, the afternoon sun was waning. I was damned anxious. We had no semblance of a perimeter. And with no luck in knocking out the most lethal of the NVA positions, with dark on its way, I was really worried about medevac and resupply. Throughout the day, through trial and error, we discovered a way to bring helicopters in without subjecting them to direct enemy fire. What concerned me now was that dark would prevent the critical accuracy required on the pilot's parts in maneuvers like go back one click, kilometer, and get on the deck, come in on the deck at 182 degrees, and when you see a smoke in front of your nose, flare back and land right on top of it. And the final warning, don't go beyond that smoke or you're gonna find two anti-aircraft machine guns firing right down your throat. I was also terribly worried about getting the men set up for the night. While B Company had run into some heavy fighting and broke off their attack, the Tigers and Murphy's men were still in the thick of it, with the Tigers being held up in a trench by four machine guns. As daylight grew shorter, so did my patience with my boys. God damn it, Jim, I yelled at Gardner on the radio. Get those positions cleaned out right now. No more fucking around, do you understand? It's getting dark. Knock out those guns, and I mean now. I was not in a position to see what happened next, but as the story was related to me by Dennis Foley, Gardner's XO, Jim made my words his personal mission. He took as many grenades as he could carry in his shirt and started running up the trench by himself. Slugs were snapping all around him as he ran to the first machine gun bunker. He threw himself against it below the hole, pulled the pin on one of his grenades, and threw it in. As the grenade went off and the machine gun in the bunker went limp, Gardner moved on to the next position. He repeated the drill, only this time someone inside the bunker threw the grenade out of the hole in front of him. Jim was hit as it went off, but he just took another grenade, threw it into the hole, and permanently closed down the gun inside. To the astonishment of his men, he pushed on to the third bunker, an anti-aircraft position that contained a machine gun mounted on a tripod. The Tiger CO destroyed that gun too with another grenade, and then burned an X across the aperture of the bunker with his rifle to make sure there was no one left alive inside. But this moment proved his downfall. Simultaneously, an enemy machine gun in yet another position took him under fire and hit him four times across the chest. Jim reportedly turned around and said, "It's the best I can do." And then he dropped, KIA. The Medal of Honor Jim Gardner would receive posthumously for his heroic stand, like the belief, expressed to me by a couple of his men, that he'd made his charge to absolve himself for the deaths of his recon troops by that short mortar round 3 months before, was little consolation. For all our partying as equals, and for all his scrounging escapades where my seniority meant nothing except that I'd keep him out of trouble, Gardner and all the other young officers who were my friends never forgot that I was their commander. That when I said jump, I might mean to the moon, and I'd expect it done with no questions asked. They performed because they trusted and respected me, and they knew I wouldn't ask them to do what I wouldn't do or hadn't done myself. But when someone dies for you, as Jim Gardner died for me, a fact I repressed for many years. It's the worst of all crosses a combat leader has to bear. Gardner's courageous bunker busting did not unpin the Tigers, and I needed them to break contact and link up with Murphy's people. It was the only way we could set up a defensive perimeter before dark. I moved as close to them as I could, which still left us separated by a fairly open space in the village, and got Dennis Foley on the horn. "You're in charge," I said. "I want you to collect your guys and get out of there. I'm right across from you. We'll lay down covering fire and a lot of arty. When it comes in, haul ass over here to my position." The brave Tigers dodged and weaved their way across that open space under heavy fire and arrived miraculously 100% intact. When Dennis joined us, Daryl and I were lying behind a blown-down coconut tree, on the other side of which a whole bunch of pigs were frantically running around. While we remained sheltered from the steel cyclone going on just over our heads, from time to time we'd hear a loud squeal as one of the pigs got caught in the crossfire. One pig had the good sense to hide on our side, but then, when we suddenly got an intense amount of small arms fire, the pig stuck its head up and got blown away. Insufficient training. Meanwhile, Foley took a slug through his helmet. It came out the front, not touching him but knocking one of the arms off his glasses. It was the second time he'd been hit like that since the battle began. The first had been during the Tiger's initial attack, when he'd taken a slug in the back that actually went right through his jacket and equipment, missing his body entirely. The boy had luck. I'd been talking down choppers all afternoon with great success. One of the most recent lifts had carried a magazine reporter who jumped out of the bird in a yellow short-sleeved shirt and baseball cap and dashed over to our fallen coconut tree. "Hi," he chirped. "Where's all the action?" I pointed straight up and went back to fighting the battle. A short time later, I noticed the reporter was poking his head over the log, taking a few photographs and coming back down. "Hey, Mr. Reporter," I said, "that's not a very cool thing to do. Stick your camera up and take pictures, but not your head, or it'll be goodbye, Clark Kent." Not 5 minutes later, I looked over again, only to see one very dead reporter. He'd taken a slug between the eyes. I'd just finished telling a couple of Tigers to stack the reporter's body with the rest of our dead when the voice of an unknown chopper pilot came up on the radio. "Savvy Volley 5," he said, addressing me by call sign. "This is Outlaw 5-3, inbound, resupply and packs, passengers. Mark LZ, over." "Outlaw 5-3, this is Savvy Volley 5. Look, it's really hot down here, so I'm going to tell you how to get in." I started giving the pilot my detailed instructions, but almost immediately he interrupted me. "Savvy Volley 5, just tell me where you want me. Don't tell me how to do it, okay? I think I'm a little more qualified than you in this job." "Look, buddy," I snapped. "This is a bad, bad LZ. Come in a certain way or you'll be blown out of the sky." "I say again, if you want these supplies, just mark your LZ." "Roger on that," I said, and popped a smoke. It was like watching a movie in slow motion. First, the ship was coming in. Then the ship was being stitched as greenish-blue NVA tracers burst out of the dusk-darkened hedgerow on both flanks. Then the ship was losing control. It was quietly beautiful and, in a way, exceptionally funny to see it spin out and crash on the deck. I sent an element over to retrieve the supplies and the freshly wounded. No one was badly hurt, though Doug Holtz, who was kicking out the supplies as the battalion's support platoon leader, got an easy Purple Heart when a bullet zinged across his ass. Holtz was another lucky guy. This was his fourth Purple Heart, and he'd never received more than a scratch. The worst casualty in the incident was the chopper itself. $300,000 worth of lift destroyed with a couple of 9-cent bullets and the help of a smart-ass pilot who knew it all. As night fell, we buttoned up. I had Bravo Company set up a perimeter on the outskirts of the village, and the Tigers and C-2502 set up the best perimeter they could in the village itself. We brought in mortars and dug in deep, concentrating our efforts on blocking the enemy's withdrawal routes, mostly with artillery. Enemy dead were strewn all over the area, while I was sick in my heart over the Tiger casualties. At least we, not the enemy, held the village of Mekong. Then Al Heiser called me with his casualty figures. 19 KIA, he said, a score of wounded. I felt as if I'd been slugged in the gut with a sledgehammer. What? I asked. I didn't believe him. He repeated the figures, and tears sprang to my eyes. All told, the battle had claimed the lives of 26 of my men and wounded 28. It was a terrible price, in no way justified by the 66 NVA bodies and 20-odd Chinese-made crew-served and individual weapons we found the next morning, or the fact that we were the proud possessors of this demolished village, which we'd soon pull out of anyway. The casualty figures sickened me even more as the story of Bravo's fight unfolded. Heiser had launched his attack just as the Tigers had, across a wide-open field. His second platoon had been mowed down. The whole thing was just a shining example of bad, bad training. At the infantry school they taught, always use a concealed avenue of approach. But these were just words, taught mainly in a classroom. When on the training field, troops learned that all they had to do was get there first, and damn how they did it, to be declared king of the mountain by an umpire who knew no better himself. I'd seen it with my own eyes at Campbell, and now the chickens had come home to roost. At fault, too, perhaps, were the habits Gardner and Heiser had brought to Mi Khan. Gardner's formed in the open rice paddies of Quinyan, where our opponent had been skillful, but in the final analysis he'd still been a local guerrilla, and Heiser's from the super-aggressive 173rd. In their eagerness to cross swords with the NVA, perhaps neither man had realized how tough the big leagues could be. Tiger XO Dennis Foley shed additional light on his unit's tragic maneuver. Apparently, the choice not to take the concealed avenue of approach along the dry stream bed had been made after a quick recon revealed that thick 6-foot grass, excellent concealment, was growing out from the riverbank for some distance. Gardner had acted on the assumption that this grass would provide a concealed avenue of approach all the way to his destination on the enemy's flank at Mi Khan. As for my own mistakes at Mi Khan, as yet I wasn't sure, and it would take a lot of thought and another good battle before I would be. For now, all I knew was our losses were far too heavy to claim victory, although that was how the news people and higher headquarters would describe the battle, with the price of U.S. lives only moderate. The fact was we'd been sucked in and eaten alive. We had attacked machine guns as the British and the French had in World War I, and I was heartsick at the result. Task Force Hackworth was disbanded when Colonel Rogers and the battalion staff flew into Mi Khan the next afternoon. After a first light artillery and TAC air strike, the remnants of Bravo Company had entered Mi Khan unopposed that morning, the NVA having run away throughout the night to fight another day. I couldn't have been happier to see Doc Raphael Benjamin, the battalion surgeon, hop out of that chopper. He was the one person I knew I could talk to about the tragic events of the day before. Raphael was my friend. The good doctor had volunteered for the 1-101 to get out of a boring job with the 70th Engineer Battalion, and we'd hit it off from the first day he joined 1-327. We'd started out sharing meals. Raphael would take his, all the medics, Daryl's, and my sea rations, plus whatever else he could scrounge, and cook up big delicious stews. Before long, I'd started sacking out on one of the stretchers in his aid station, and at night, when there were blackout conditions and we couldn't read, we'd just bullshit across the tent until we fell asleep. Tall and thin enough to stand between raindrops, Raphael hailed from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. At 27, he'd been drafted into the Army right out of medical school, leaving behind his wife, Karen, and two small sons. He was a brilliant doc, brave and caring and well-loved by the troops. He was an unflappable kind of guy who, as a civilian, found that the hardest part of the soldier's life was having to live like an animal for months on end. From the Korea days, I didn't even think twice about living like an animal, or how uncomfortable or unpleasant it might be for the troops, who'd never had to do it before. Raphael, who'd sing his little blues song about drinking muddy water and sleeping in a hollow log, did a lot for my awareness that way, opening my eyes to things I'd stopped noticing, and he became one of the great teachers of my life, about things I'd never noticed at all. And now he would be my sounding board for the disheartening events that had taken place at Mi Kan the day before. But that night, just as we started talking, a firefight broke out on the east side of the perimeter, complete with flares, grenades, and blazing rifles. We ran over there. "Hold your fire!" I shouted over the din. "Hold that fire!" The leaders along the perimeter heard me and took up the call. Before long, the weapons were silent. "All right, what's happening here?"
"There was a lot of firing at our outpost, sir,"
Johnny Adams, the 4.2 mortar platoon leader, reported. "Then there was firing into our perimeter, so we fired back." I called out to the two men on the outpost, but there was no reply. Raphael and I headed into the night. We snaked our way out of the perimeter until we came upon the OP. It had been overrun, and a still-lit cigarette glowing in the darkness beside two very still bodies explained how. For me, it was 11 November 1952 all over again. The two men were still alive, if only barely. After spraying the area and flipping a couple of grenades, I took one of the guys by the legs while Raphael tried to grab the same one under his arms to take him back to our position. But the doc's hand kept slipping away,